Ah, see, they've got me back in the U.S. That was a quick flight. Hi, everybody. Indeed, from the high desert, I am Art Bell. Dr. Bart Cusco is my guest. Degrees on degrees. He's now an attorney as well. And I do want to ask about patent law because it seems to me that in this technological world we live in, and it certainly is increasingly so, a lot of that which is sent to the patent office, and I don't want to bad rap the patent office at all, but it's so complicated and so technological that I wonder, frankly, how they make judgments about what's a good and a bad invention these days. We'll ask in a moment. Caulking in the rubber under the fixtures. I'm really going to do that. A couple of interesting fast blasts here. Opposite kind of. One from New York City. Juana says, the main reason I'm considering moving out of Manhattan is the noise. Level of sound even makes sleeping difficult. My poor dog is a wreck because of the daily walks he does. They're filled with honks, booms, and bams, making the general hum an unending assault. And then from Oregon, ham operator there says, why can I only work if there's noise in the room? I need the TV or talk radio or something to function at my best. Thanks. Cherie. So there are two opposites, Bart. One who can't stand the noise and the other who can't work and function without it.
I think both points are accurate. And in particular, if it's light background noise, I find if it's music without words in it, like orchestral music for me, that works just fine. If there's words in it, I find it distracting. I've told the story before how when I sat for the bar on the 2 days where everyone's typing madly, the typing creates a wonderful background approximation of white noise, keeps the brain energized. On the day of all multiple choice, it's dead quiet. You can hear every noise and every pin drop, literally. And it's very different. You get kind of tired, too. So a little bit of noise energizes. Too much is too much. I also like to comment on the dog in New York. We know that noise does affect the environment and affects animals. But we haven't thought enough, I think, Art, about how it affects sea creatures. I touched on this in the book, but I have done a lot more research on it since.
Oh.
And it's pertinent because in 2 days, we're about to, the United States Navy with the Australian Navy, about to embark on something called Project Talisman Sabre, a vast military experiment off the coast of Australia in the Barrier Reef Park. There'll be 30 vessels there, and they'll be using their very controversial medium frequency sonar and lower frequency sonar. Now, in the past, and I talk about this in the book, and you can go online and look at the photos, when the Navy's used their low frequency sonar in various places like the Bahamas and famously in the Canary Islands, about 4 hours later on the beach are a bunch of dead beaked whales bleeding right from their ears. And when you do autopsies on them, you find bubbles in their brain and things that look like they suffered from the bends. Beaked whales are the deepest going mammals. They can be down for an hour. They can go a mile deep. And so far as we know, most of them just die and sink. But if you go online, it's really startling to look at this. So there have been many injunctions. I just got back from Hawaii. There were a lot of lawsuits filed a couple weeks ago trying to get the Navy to go easy on the sonar experiments around Hawaii since so many beaked whales and related creatures are there. But I didn't realize how not just noisy New York City is and the land, but how noisy the oceans are. The measurements off the coast of California show that the average noise is about 10 times greater than it was, say, 40 years ago, and only getting louder. And it's doing that because of three things. First are the Navy-type experiments. Those are big impulses. Second, and really dangerous, are the air guns used to look for oil. And the most common are about a million boats at any time on the sea just pinging the bottom with sonar.
Right.
And you got to think of what that does. Remember, in water, sound travels much more efficiently than in air.
Right.
If you ever go underwater and you try to locate a sound, you really can't do it because it's about five times faster. The way you locate sound right now in air is the sound hits one ear a little faster than the other. Underwater, as far as your brain's concerned, it's hitting at the same time. You know, fish and sea creatures can't see but a few meters in the water, but they can hear up to kilometers, many, many, many miles. In some cases, apparently hundreds of miles. So evolution has adapted sea creatures very differently than us. And when you start fiddling with their sonar structure, their brain structure, mm-hmm. and bombarding them with with the kind of pressure waves. I mean, the waves that come from an air gun looking for oil, they're on the order of 200 to 230 decibels. So someone said, that's like being at the base of the space shuttle when it takes off. It's just incomprehensible. It's trillions of times louder than the noise in your room.
Well, the oceans are in enough trouble right now as it is, and sea life is certainly in enough trouble. And I was aware of the lawsuits in Hawaii.
Right.
Is anybody raising any legal noise about what's going to occur near Australia, near the Great Reef?
You know, I don't know if there have been specific actions. That's tough to do because of jurisdictional issues. Usually go to federal court and ask for an injunction. There's been a lot of those. And Navy's agreed quite recently, I think, to study it more closely. At the same time, you know, they do have to test their submarines. The International Whaling Commission, backed by 200 top whale experts and scientists from around the world, have come down opposed to it. You know, the European Union, it hasn't banned the use of that kind of sonar, but it has recommended that it be avoided. I don't know if this particular action are, but everyone's watching it. It's a very big deal in the noise world because it's just about to happen. It starts Tuesday, and it goes on for about 2 weeks. It'll be all up to, I think, 17,000 or so troops from the U.S. over there and the exercise, including nuclear U.S. submarines.
I must admit, I haven't thought a lot about the noise except from the stories emanating from Hawaii.
Right.
Because of the lawsuits. But yes, I guess undersea noise, and particularly, as you point out, the air guns they use to look for oil, that's a lot of noise. And, you know, the ecological situation in the world right now is pretty delicate. So
it's very delicate. You know. And it's like the case of the boombox. Somebody gets a benefit or the muffler missing that you talked about, and the costs are imposed on third parties. Now, you know, we have unintentionally polluted the oceans. I don't think anyone meant to do that, but it's a third-party market failure kind of thing. And we're doing it now in this noise way. And I really wasn't aware of that until I researched this and didn't realize how it harms. And for example, squid seem to be very sensitive to noise. And once you have a look at the crust, a mining look at the crust through an air gun, big schools of squid will often just float up dead. And we just don't know how much damage it's causing and the stress effects, although a lot of people are starting to look at it.
All right, let's switch to, for a moment, patents. I'm very interested in that, and I wonder how these days and whether the Patent Office is able to keep up with the kind of technological patents they're receiving or requests for patents they're receiving, whether they have the brain power in staff to make these kinds of judgments.
I don't want to question the brain power. I mean, after all, Albert Einstein was a patent examiner. But the staff, I think, is the issue. The money is the issue. They get over 300,000 filings a year. And as you said, these are real complicated.
Right.
They come in at the absolute cutting edge, and kind of beyond the cutting edge of biotech. You know, as of the last 10 or so years, you can now get patents on software, strange new business methods, the latest thing. For example, if you're a lawyer and you get the American Bar Association's journal, the big story, one of the big stories in there is the fact that part of your legal practice can be patented now. And so how could that be? But
yeah,
you can do it in terms of how you fund. Somebody got a patent on how you fund a certain type of tax shelter involving trust. It's for rich people. And if you funded that tax shelter with certain types of stock options, well, you know, somebody, you have to pretty much get a license. And there's something like 50 or so pending patents have actually been issued on that, and 100 or so, nearly 100 pending. To deal with all that, the backlog is huge. It has only increased. There was an effort to speed up patents that might be involved in the war on terrorism, but that I don't think has gone very far. It's understaffed. It's underpaid. You know, it is a government bureaucracy. I mean, they mean well. And I do think they have a lot of talented people. And when the patents come in, they do assign it to different groups. And, you know, in other words, goes to the biotech group or goes to the medical group or the chemistry group. A lot of that overlaps.
Yeah.
And it's just real hard stuff.
Yeah, it's got to be hard. If you file, say, I don't know, a fairly complicated a biomedical patent of some sort these days, what are you looking at in terms of cost, time before you finally get it or don't? What?
First, there's several hundred dollars just naked filing fee. That's if you kind of commit legal suicide and do it yourself. You have to take it to a patent attorney. And that's going to be probably a few thousand dollars, maybe several if it's real complicated.
Hmm.
And this, by the way, is kind of getting at the heart of where the debate is in Congress now about how to deal with the patent situation. Do you want to favor the bigger company or the smaller inventor? There's lots of arguments either ways. The system now that we've adopted is 20 years from date of filing.
Oh, my God.
And so the trouble is the backlog has gotten worse. There are some patents that take up to 7 or 8 years to issue. So you would think it would be from date of issue. It used to be 17 years from the date the patent issued. That's no longer true. So it's 20 years, and it just depends. If it's a biotech patent, it's likely, if it's something that really has economic merit, to be heavily contested, and it can take quite a while. And then the law has changed radically just in the last 2 months about what happens after it's issued. But it's a crapshoot. It's very expensive. A tremendous amount of high-tech innovation, the cash, the R&D money, Art, is spent on patent infringement and getting cross-licenses.
Yes.
In general, on IP litigation. And it's not frivolous litigation. This is complex stuff. I'll give you an example. One of the most famous cases in patent law recently had to do with the question, who interprets the claims of a patent?
Mm-hmm.
There's about 20 claims. It's based on the old prospecting model of claims to land. And it had always been the case that the jury interpreted it because it's a matter of fact. But the Supreme Court looked at that, Justice Souter writing from the majority in 1996 in the so-called Markman case, and they said 9-0, this really should be for the judge because claims are like statutes. So suddenly the law changed. But the neat thing about the case to me was, as a fuzzy theorist, the whole dispute centered on one word, the word inventory. And it had to do with automated dry cleaning. And the parties both had legitimate interpretations of that word. Words are vague. Words are fuzzy. And so you're going to, and they litigated that all the way to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
And by the way, now, when you bring a patent action, the first thing you have to do is have what's called a Markman hearing, which is where the judge, either early on in the process or right up before trial, makes a decision about what the claims mean. That's a huge battle. It's something I think like 40% of the outcomes are appealed. And oddly enough, if it goes to a jury, the jury is not allowed to interpret the patent, yet if there's an infringing patent, they have to compare the two patents and make a decision. So the patent law is really complex and in flux. And I want to say another thing. Very few judges have any technical training.
Yeah.
And this
let me tell you something, Bart. I have friends who do invent electronic things, new electronic things. And they are so fed up with the whole patent system.
I bet they are.
That what they're doing is they're simply going ahead and manufacturing product X with this new invention in it. And they're saying, look, instead of getting involved in patent law and lawsuits that are going to come out of it and all the rest of it, we might as well put this product on the market.
Right.
Make as much money as we can, as fast as we can, because we know somebody's going to steal it, and not get involved in the big litigation that's sure to happen, and even trying to file a patent. Just go ahead and market the damn thing, make the money, and be done with it.
Here's the trouble, Theodore, and I understand the motivation and the frustration of the inventor in that case, because the average patent litigation case can run, I think it's $2 million now, but that's got to be on the downside. The cases I've been involved with, in different ways over the years, I've seen them up to $10, $15, $20 million in terms of litigation fees, and really warranted fees. The problem is, you go ahead and do that, Art, then you may be looking down the wrong side of the gun barrel because someone else has got a patent or is getting a patent, and you may have to defend anyway against that. You might have been much better off having gone in and gotten the patent yourself.
I don't think there's any easy
way out of this.
Yeah, apparently not. And I'll bring that up, but that's finally the decision they came to. All right. So,
one other thing, one decision you make as an inventor is, do I want to go with a patent, which in the best case is 20 years, or trade secret? I mean, Coca-Cola has done real well with its formula locked in a vault in Atlanta for over 100 years. That would have run out on the patent. They had a patent, what's called a design patent, on the shape of that bottle. They also have a trademark on it that's still good. That design patent ran out, but they had made the decision to just patent that technology. Well, it would be a very different soft drink world.
So what they have is a trade secret. In other words, they've got the secret in a vault
right
somewhere, and that legally means what?
Legally means that you can, if you like, you can try to reverse engineer a trade secret, and that's okay. But what you can't do is use unauthorized means. You can't go in and steal it, for example. And I have a book a few feet from me that purports to have an approximation of the formula, but I would hate to see someone who tried to make a company based on that. There'd be a lot of litigation. Trade secrets have the advantage if they have economic value and you reasonably maintain the secrecy through a badging system and a variety of other ways, can last forever. And so a lot of inventors simply go that route.
Okay, well, that's a good tip, I guess. So your advice to, and we have many inventors in this audience.
My advice is the same as before. Get a lawyer and get a good one and pay for it up front and do it right.
Well, I guess that's good advice. I guess. It sounds like good advice for somebody in your business.
My principal income is through books and university, but I really think if you're getting involved in inventions and you want to make money on it, Art, there's so much. The hardest document in all of law to draft is not a contract. That's hard. It's a patent claim. It has to appropriately capture the invention and as wide as you can throw the net and anticipate objections from opponents and from the Patent and Trademark Office. And it has to prepare for a potential massive legal proceeding in civil court, some of the most complex law there is. It's very difficult to balance the science on the one hand and the law on the other. You need an expert to do that. Okay. And also, if someone sends you a letter, which happens all the time to companies, saying, hey, we think you're infringing our patent, sign this licensing agreement or else, you need to see an attorney.
Okay. It sure makes business a complicated affair, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
Albert Einstein published his first paper on the special theory of relativity in 1905. What did he contribute to the history of noise?
At the same year, that famous year, he put forth the first real mathematical description of what we now call Brownian motion, or the heat diffusion equation. The modern science of noise begins with it. If Einstein had done nothing else, he just published a noise paper and died, he'd be one of the great names in physics because of that. And right up, it's also tied into it's the bridge from classical physics through quantum mechanics to where we are now. But gets a little credit for it. In the book, I, in the back, try to lay out some of very detailed end notes, but not in the text itself, to give you some sense of his accomplishment. And then an incredible year of 1905 when he published that and many other things.
Can you reduce that to English for me? The first part.
The Brownian motion part.
Yeah.
Brownian motions, when Robert Brown in the early 19th century looked at pollen grains under a microscope, he saw they were bouncing around randomly. Huh. And we have since called that random motion Brownian motion. And the more we've zoomed down at things, the more they bounce. So it appears that the ultimate structure of matter, the universe, is random. And quantum mechanics has only confirmed that. And in particular, it bounces around in a pattern tied to that white noise, in fact, that you mentioned and demonstrated earlier.
Right.
So physical matter, molecules are not, and atoms, they're not like you learned in grade school where they were like marbles together. They're always bouncing around, colliding, and they don't look like marbles at all. They're actually clouds. It's a random froth, and the deeper you go into the universe, all the way down to Planck level, 10 to the minus 43 level, a real tiny area, it's random froth atop the froth, and Einstein really opened that door with his 1905 paper.
Okay. Bart, if you could, we live in an amazing age, with nanotechnology and all the bio stuff that's going on. If you could be in any field right now, or let me restructure that, what do you think is the fastest, most productive moving field of technology right now?
I think nanotech. I think I would combine chemistry with computer science, something like that.
Do you see that?
Reflect that.
I was about to ask. Do you see that in patent filings?
Absolutely. It's a frontier. Well, it's the real assault on matter underway right now. It's a golden age. It's a gold rush.
A gold rush. So perhaps you can give us some idea after the break, which is coming up here shortly, of what we can expect. I know you keep an eye on patent filings, which means that you should have some idea of some of the real practical things that are about to happen in the nano world, right?
Some idea.
Uh-huh. All right.
Patents are promises. The product's actually delivered.
Yes. All right. Bart Cosco, hold it right there. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell. Here I am. Bart Cosco is my guest, and we're talking ostensibly about noise, but all kinds of things, actually. He's a brilliant man with knowledge in many, many areas. Want to find out what's going on with nanotechnology? Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Well, all right, Bart, what do you see coming? I know nanotechnology has the potential to truly change the world we're living in.
Yes.
How much so?
I think quite radically. I think it changes how we manipulate the basic elements of electrons and photons, so-called fermions and bosons. We've done a lot of stuff with light. We're doing more things now with electricity, not at this macroscopic level, but at the nanoscopic level and lower. And what I said before the break, Art, I think is, and what we referred to Einstein, is really the heart of it, the difficulty of it. Everything is random down there. Everything looks like noise, appears to be noise.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you work with that? How do you compute with that is the issue. And to make the point a little more vividly, a student once asked me, well, what's the secret to the universe? And my answer was, it's written in stone on a grave in Austria, in Vienna, Austria. And it's on the grave of the great physicist Ludwig Boltzmann. And it says, S equals K log W. It's the definition for entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, that things get more disordered. And it was that S equals K log W, the fact that there's a logarithm of something random, the W is like a probability, that led Max Planck to modern quantum mechanics. That was the insight of going over and viewing things now fundamentally from a random or noise-like perspective. Einstein came back to that and extended Brownian motion. But it starts there. Well, that's great. We can explain things. And it means today we usually work with averages. What we want to do, Art, is get down there in the small and work with individual photons and electrons as best we can. And in particular, to create gates, on-off switches, ones or zeros, at least on average, for quantum computing, for example, or in nano computing, ands and ors and nots and ifs and those kinds of things. And those are coming. Some of those, there have been filings of patents, and we had, a really big breakthrough last month in the journal Science from some French researchers. They demonstrated the first electron gun, where you can shoot a single electron, just like a gun, like a single photon. And that hadn't been done before. And you can approach quantum computing in a much more powerful way, in theory, because electrons are what are called fermions, and they're different than photons. So photons or bosons, they can pass through one another without interference. Electrons can't. And so they're entangled in very different ways. But we've never before been able to quantize a voltage like we can do now and control it. We have with this the emission and absorption out of what's called a quantum dot of an individual electron, a kind of quantized alternating current.
Yeah, it's going over a lot of heads out there.
Okay.
What is this going to mean?
It means that you can implement or test at least the elements of a lot of quantum computers. Remember, computers still are a bunch of ones and zeros.
Mm-hmm.
And the neat thing about quantum computers is they work in parallel. And instead of one or two registers computing yes or no answers, you have a whole bunch of them, and they can suddenly crack problems that you just couldn't do combinatorially otherwise. The trouble is making those things. You know, it's going to take a long time to have viable quantum computers. We have little experiments going on. Some of my colleagues have done that, but we need to be able to test that and to have, in effect, switches, on-off switches. So the electron gun is a big step in that direction.
Okay, well, let's look ahead and say...
It'd be crazy not to.
Let's look ahead and say we actually create a working quantum computer.
Yes.
What will that potentially give us that we don't have now?
Among many other things, it could crack your security for wireless codes. Mostly encryption techniques we use are based on taking big prime numbers and multiplying them.
Right.
And then to try to figure out whether what you've got figure out what the product of primes is very difficult. You really can't do it today. But if you had a lot of quantum computers working in parallel, you could arguably break things. So it could potentially undermine security in a very deep way.
Great.
It cuts that way. On the other hand, if you and I are having a quantum communication, if we're talking a quantum channel, because of the nature of entanglement, we'll be able to detect in many cases whether anybody eavesdrops on us through very strange. The thing about the quantum effects is this action at a distance that seems impossible when things are entangled. And so computationally, if there are mathematical-type algorithms that we just don't have fast enough computers to solve, quantum computing has the promise to solve those. But it's been real tough delivering on that. On the other hand, there's comparatively simple nanotechnology, which with the help of the carbon nanotube is making great strides. There are many patents on using carbon nanotubes as different types of transistors. A lot of companies working on that. We're all waiting to see. We hear a lot of promises. And They've been used in different devices, but a nanotube looks like rolled up chicken wire with, at the intersections of chicken wire, carbon atoms there. So it's like diamond. It's a big molecule.
All of this so far sounds great for the military. I mean, they'll crack codes, and maybe it's great for the terrorists. I don't know. But turn it around.
We cannot crack terrorist codes now if they use publicly available encryption in many cases. Right. You could run all those underground computers at Fort Meade at the National Security Agency. And so I understand it. They still won't crack a lot of it.
Right. I guess that's great for the military. But, I mean, for the people listening right now, what kind of products can they expect that will change their lives?
In the case of nanotech, I think ultimately we have devices that would enable you to build things, or at least to compute things, but to build things out of matter. I mean, the classic sci-fi example is you take a bunch of dirt, throw it into the nanomachine, heat it up with some energy, give it instructions, and like Aristotle, who said you can combine a blueprint with cement and get a building, out pops a hamburger. I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, that's a bit off, and there's all kind of problems overcome in the atoms. But the first order, we can strengthen materials so that you don't have to worry about a side impact collision in a car, for example.
Come back to the hamburger.
Yep.
I like burgers. How would that work? I mean, remember Star Trek with the a replicator?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about? How would you create the hamburger?
The classic Eric Drexler model for 20 years now has been that you would take a pile of matter, say it's housed in an orange, which is just a bunch of molecules, disassemble them, and reassemble those molecules into an apple. The trouble is getting your hands, because of so-called sticky fingers, on a lot of those molecules and energy required to break the bonds and make the bonds. That's always been the fantasy. So it is like the teleportation scheme where you dissolve and become reconstructed on the other side. Very difficult to do the assembler, disassembler, and long before that, art is simply enhancing materials and improving communications. For example, I'm happy to say the lead article in the November-December journal of the Transactions on Nanotechnology was by me and my colleagues at USC, Ian Lee and others, refining an earlier result we had on using individual carbon nanotubes as very tiny antennas, and in particular adding noise to them to boost their ability to detect faint signals. So if you have severe hearing loss, what's going on in many cases is that your inner ear is lost a lot of the little hairs that detect signals.
That's right.
It's like a comb losing teeth. And as you get older, they fall apart. If you get an accident, they bend and break, and that can lead to tinnitus, for example, which a lot of people have. But wouldn't it be neat if we could, with a little bit of invasive surgery, go in there and replace that inner ear with something at least as good as you started with, maybe much better, with lots of little, instead of hairs, little carbon nanotubes that can detect those frequencies and maybe do a lot of things.
That would be incredible. How far are we from that?
You know, we at USC have at least put that on the drawing board. I know other groups have done that. That kind of thing, I think, is feasible. I call that nanosignal processing. That's very different than trying to assemble things. We're still just routing information. And I think at some point, a real nano shirt where the materials are stitched together in a way that adapt and chemically change, you know, convert your smells or whatever they happen to be into whatever you want them to be, into cologne-like smells.
Wow.
And change color to reflect the environment like an octopus would. A lot of people are looking at that because that's signal processing. We have the algorithms all worked out in theory of how to convert inputs into outputs. And trying to get little devices to approximate them is the issue. And the thing about nanotubes, you can make a lot of them. But as I mentioned before, they tend to get stuck together. And when you put them in a raisin, it's very hard to unstick them. But that's a technology problem. We'll overcome it.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about this spooky action at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
These two particles that have to have some original association with each other. But then I think you can take one of them to the other side of the world.
That's right.
And it will flip and flop in exact concert with the other one.
Or at least in some kind of statistically correlated way. That's right. That's the hardest thing to grasp about quantum computing. And it looks like magic. It looks like action at a distance.
What is magic? Because there has got to be, and I bet eventually there will be discovered, some kind of communication between the two. Now, we may not understand on what frequency or in what way, but there's got to be something. And people say, no, there isn't. Well,
and Einstein shared your intuition. I think I understand that. You know, we I don't think I have a good sense. Another thing, Art, what happened to your past life of 30 minutes ago? Where did it go? Now, we really don't know. I mean, we know it's sitting there in the space-time continuum, but can we access that? And maybe if we could, it would give some insight into what appears to be action at a distance because of the time thing. But we tend to associate, you know, whatever now is with, like, the current playing of a movie and that's ignore right. that what you are is the entire film in the camera.
Do you have any sense of how these two particles act in concert without communication that we're able to detect?
I can give you the mathematical answer. I can do it on the phone, but I understand mathematically. Intuitively, I really don't. You learn the properties of entanglement, what to expect, how to manipulate the equations. And you know that to the extent these things have been tested or approximately tested, it's come up so far so good. But I don't think anyone has that, what we'd all like to see, that next layer down, so-called hidden variables explanation of it.
Got to be something somewhere. There just has to be.
Well, hopefully we'll encounter aliens or someone or find something else written on a gravestone somewhere that tells us. But I think we'll have a tough time at this point figuring that out. It does seem to be beyond the scope of the models we have.
And so far, any attempt at communication using this entanglement has failed, yes?
No, there's been I think it was the Danube River, where some European scientists were able to send, teleport, as I recall, a qubit, a quantum bit, from one side of the river to the other. Now, these are kind of toy experiments, but there's been some simple demonstrations of that. Not the kind of thing that we're all thinking of, a simultaneous sort of occurrence or conversations at a distance. But that potentially could come. Again, the trouble here is the noise, the random nature of quantum mechanics. Most of these properties we talk about are only averages. Once you go to Boltzmann's grave, once you get the world of entropy that Planck found, if he didn't introduce this, Art, what happened was you had what was called the ultraviolet catastrophe, which said as you increase the frequency of light, its intensity went up. And if that were true, when you look at a fireplace, your eyeballs should burn out. Your eyeballs don't burn out.
Right.
And you light a match, you should go blind. And instead, it kind of goes up and then it falls off. And to make that work, the quantum hypothesis came in with Boltzmann. And that only says on average, but all kind of strange things can happen. So you're in a room now, and there are air molecules. But it's totally permissible. In fact, it has to occur mathematically that there's a configuration of those molecules where they all go to one side of the room and anybody in the room would suffocate. It's just that that's so infinitesimally small in probability, that so-called fluctuation. And we're now getting a sense in the noise research of how to manipulate those fluctuations, in the case of what are called Brownian motors and other structures, to do work or do forms of energy transportation.
Do you think that eventually we're going to be able to download the contents of a human mind into perhaps a quantum computer, or perhaps even a computer that will come before a quantum computer?
Yes, I do. I think we usually talk about the other direction, the upload. But if we can sample, if you could put a big nano comb through your brain, remember there's no bones in the brain, and think of those nanotubes or quantum wires or equivalent, there would be trillions of these things going through and detecting the local structure of the neural communications. We should be able to approximate it, not get it exactly, but a pretty good engineering approximation of your neural circuitry and replicate that and, in effect, run that like a simulation, but run it at much faster speeds. In fact, it is one way of getting into a chip and the heaven-like things into a chip.
And if you were able to do that, what would you have?
I think you would have an approximation of going to heaven or hell, depending on the case, but you would have your stream of bits, your being, your pattern, would exist in that form of the bit, so you'd have a soul, but it wouldn't have the problems of where the soul goes. Your consciousness wouldn't be limited by how fast or slow electrical pulses flow through neural wires. It would occur millions, billions, maybe trillions of times faster. Access and subject only to the speed of light of all knowledge bases and databases. The ability to create worlds just by thinking of them, and that, I think, is heaven in a chip.
How do you know, though, that you would transfer the consciousness? That part you can't know, and you surely can't know. You transfer the soul.
Just a minute. I think the consciousness is like where we are in the movie right now. We're playing the movie. It's got a little energy and heat and light behind it, but there's the whole strip, which is the brain. And if we can go in and really approximate what's going on in your brain, not just its architecture, but its current functioning, so, well, these neurons are on, and these are firing, we have a pulse train over here and not a pulse train here, then in theory, we should be able to take a snapshot of your brain, just like we can take a snapshot now of your computer when you back it up.
Right.
And that snapshot, when unfolded, as it unfolds in real time, would be what we had heretofore called consciousness.
I'm trying to assimilate that. In other words, but it would be just a snapshot, or could you take all that a person is, transfer it to a computer? Would you then have two separately unfolding consciousness tracks?
Well, you might, and that's a real problem here, that you could get the existence of the new thing, but you wouldn't have the uniqueness, because you can make 100 copies, a million copies. It could run in parallel.
Yes.
But I do want to make a little point of distinction. I don't think it's going from you to a computer. I think it's going from computer to computer. On this model, you and I and the rest of us are just computers. The meat computer is 3 pounds of neural tissue. It is a computing device at this level, very sophisticated, sloppy thing, needs sleep, lots of sugar, things like that. But it is a computing device. It is playing a kind of music that we call consciousness and mind, and we can play it on other instruments.
But it's a perishable device.
Highly perishable, and nature's great curse is there's no backup.
But there might be.
There might be through engineering means of backing up. But to take recordings from your corpus callosum, for example, probably with some kind of neural comb. There's proposals been out for that. But just to see like your circuit diagrams and see the flow of the circuits, we'd like to have a better sense of that. We don't have anywhere near the computing power now to do that, but that's a computational problem we can solve.
Bart, do you have any idea, because I certainly don't, in some of the government labs, and forget the government, perhaps even private labs, that aren't discussing what they're doing, but they're out way beyond what we know of as a cutting edge right now, they've got to be out there, and I wonder if they're beginning to toy with these kinds of things.
I think they speculate, or I think with the electron gun, that shows you how it tends to proceed at a piecemeal level, and I don't think the researchers typically working on that can see the forest for the trees. No fault of their own, it's just very difficult to see that. But the research is so hyper fine and its precision, as it has to be, something like that. And then you can create things, and I think someone else comes along, what are called second movers, and they put together the pieces. I don't see a lot of that, other than in science fiction and futurists like myself and others talking about that. You just don't know in advance how a new device or gadget will really be applied. One thing I like to think about is some of the most famous scientific papers published, if you go back and actually read them, what they're famous for, like what they got the Nobel Prize for, maybe a paper in economics or physics, it often wasn't even the main subject of the paper. It was some secondary thing buried in there.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard to foresee that. But I do think it will leave its footprints in the patent office. I think this began in 1945 when Glenn Seaborg was able to patent an atom. And he patented americium. And it's one of my favorite patents, because the first claim just says element 95. And it withstood scrutiny. He also patented curium. And now there's an effort to patent artificial atoms and structures like that and things built upon them. The good thing about those, remember, though, they run out after 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you can freely use and manipulate. You might ask how that was doable. As the law is, you can patent anything under the sun that's created by man. And americium is not a naturally occurring element. It's three elements above uranium. And through neutron bombardment that man brought about, you could have that artificial atom. Well, now we're going much beyond that in the various filings for quantum gates and quantum devices and nanodevices.
Well,
but it started with him.
Since you're involved in science and the law, and we're coming up to a break here, but I'm very curious how you feel about whether there's enough oversight and legal restraints in place for some of the incredible science that we're right on the edge of. In other words, scientists tend to invent, the light bulb goes off, and then they can throw the switch and do the experiment or not. And really, who's there to say not? This might be dangerous for all of society. We'll be right back.